Hello, and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
So tonight we're going to start a series on what is called the Satipatthana Sutta. And the Satipatthana Sutta is the discourse on the establishment of mindfulness. And as I was researching this topic, I was surprised on how heartwarming it was to look at the original teachings of mindfulness, almost taking time to look at the richness of history and how this wonderful tradition has been passed down 2,600 years. And like I said, there's something heartwarming about looking at the original, because I've always kind of liked the original. My favorite band is the Ramones, the original punk rockers. My favorite Star Wars movie is A New Hope, the original Star Wars. And so tonight we're going to do an overview of this discourse of the original mindfulness. And that's in hopes that we will be spending the weeks and the months to come on this Friday night to take time to diligently go through this discourse in detail. So let's prepare to nerd out. So this word mindfulness, it's an everyday term now. My mom knows what mindfulness is. It's everywhere. It's on the magazine covers, and Oprah talks about mindfulness. And it wasn't always that way. But it was in 1979, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who worked in the medical field at University of Massachusetts, and he was a Buddhist practitioner and working in medicine with chronic illness. And he decided that mindfulness may be a support for chronic illness, pain, and stress. So he developed a program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, which is an 8-week program based off of this traditional teaching, Satipatthana. But he updated it in a way that works well for stress reduction in the medical field. And since then, it has blossomed out quite beautifully in the secular world. And so ever since then, they now have mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based relapse prevention, mindfulness-based self-compassion, school-based mindfulness intervention, mindfulness-based eating solution. Mindfulness has been used as a modality in cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy. One of the components of that therapy is mindfulness. So it's all over the place now. And even in, I still remember it because I was deep into my practice, and it was in 2014, Time Magazine declared the mindful revolution. I don't know if we're still in the mindful revolution, but at least in this room, we will be. So this word mindfulness, its origins is in Buddhist traditions. And like I said, particularly in this discourse, this sutta. So it goes back 2,600 years. There was a guy named Siddhartha Gautama in northern India. And he developed this practice of mindfulness in a way. And at that time, when the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, we now call him the Buddha, when he taught this practice of mindfulness at the time and in the region he lived in, nobody wrote anything down. And so they had to orally pass this down. So when you look at these old teachings, they're very repetitive. And that's not because the Buddha repeated himself over and over again. It's that's how they recorded it, by repeating it over and over again, so they would chant in a certain way. And so you look at these old teachings and you're like, damn, the Buddha just said the same thing over and over and over again. No, that's how they recorded it. And it wasn't until maybe about 500 years, around 500 years past the Buddha's death, that they finally decided to write down these teachings. And I think there's something so beautiful about that, that they found it important in this practice so much so that they memorized it, and they chanted it, and they held so much importance to every single detail of every single word that they eventually wrote it down, and now we have it here today. And so this particular discourse is a collection out of what we call the Pali Canon. So the Pali Canon, it's rooted in this language, Pali, Sanskrit, Pali. So when they eventually wrote down the Buddhist teachings, they wrote it in this dead language now, Pali. So Pali is the commoner's version of Sanskrit. So you'll hear the word sutta in the Theravada tradition, the early Buddhist tradition, because that's Pali. You'll hear the word sutra in Mahayana traditions because that's Sanskrit. So Mahayana, later versions of Buddhism, use Sanskrit. And this Pali canon, this collection of teachings, is divided up into three baskets, they call it. The first one is the vijnanas. The vijnanas are the rule book for the monastics. So this is where we get the five precepts, but the monastics have, I think it's 311 rules they have to follow. So the first thing they have to read is all these rules on how to live as a monk. Luckily for us, we only have to follow five of those rules. We don't have to worry about the whole book. But the second of this basket is what we call the suttas. The suttas, which are the discourses. The word sutta really means thread. So it's the thread of these discourses that are passed down, that work together, that we're learning from. And then the third basket is the Abhidhamma, the almost like the commentaries on Buddhist psychology. So I want to hone in on what that middle basket is, these suttas. S-U-T-T-A, sutta. And yeah, we commonly call that like discourse, sutta. And in these suttas, there's maybe about five Bibles worth of information here. So you see this is the middle length discourses. This is Majjhima Nikaya. So the first three versions of this, they have a shorter length discourse, they have a middle length discourse, and they have a longer length discourse. So like when you pick this up, you'll get like a middle length story, lesson, discourse out of the middle length discourses. But then they also have other ones that are based off of numbers. So if you're looking for a specific list, you can look up that sutta. And then they also have other suttas based off of like themes and stuff like that. So while I'm painting with these broad strokes on all the different aspects of these discourses and suttas, what I am going into is a particular teaching from the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle length discourses, and it's number 10 of the Majjhima Nikaya. So the reason I'm saying this is to educate you so you can go see for yourself. So in the time of the Buddha, people had to memorize this, and I'm truly grateful they did, but these days you don't have to memorize it because you got your phone, you got your computer. So if you even put MN, stands for Majjhima Nikaya, if you put MN10 in Google and Buddhism, you'll find this discourse that I'm getting ready to express to you. There are different sites like Access to Insight and Sutta Central that have the entirety of the Pali Canon ready for you to look up with ease on the internet. So that's why I'm telling you all this information, to introduce you to the culture of Buddhist geekdom if you haven't already been involved in it. So I think that's kind of important. So Satipatthana Sutta. So sutta meaning discourse and the particular fashion of the baskets of the Pali Canon. And so sati, this first word that we were faced with, sati, S-A-T-I. So this word sati, we translate into mindfulness. There was a British scholar who lived in the late 1800s. He went to Sri Lanka to go translate some of these old school Buddhist teachings in Pali. And he came across this word sati, and he decided mindfulness is a good English word to use. And now we have it everywhere. And I think mindfulness is a good description for this. But there's other ways to look at this, one of which I think is a very practical way to look at sati is to remember. So to remember, not necessarily a quality of remembering like past memories, but to remember this present time experience, right? That we're watching our breath, or mindfulness of breathing, we're with our breath, and then we're lost in the stories, the judgments, the fantasies, we're falling asleep to the thinking mind, and then we remember to come back to the breath. And so that's the quality of remembering that comes with sati. And then there's other aspects of this satipatthana, and one of which I want to look at is upatthana. And upatthana really means attendance or presence. So satipatthana is a compound word where we combine sati and upatthana, which means remembering the present, remembering the presence, or mindfulness of attending to the present, something like that. So in this, I'm going to just go ahead and read you the first part of this. And as I say, as we're going through the series, you'll probably get every word of this, but I'm not going to read it all to you tonight because it's about 10 pages of this Bible worth of information here. So the discourse starts with kind of like a setting of the environment. So most of, or all of the suttas start with a location. And typically they start with, thus I have heard. And so thus I have heard the Blessed One living in Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. So this is where they're at. I'm not totally sure where this is at, somewhere in northern India. If you look online, there's probably maps of where the Kuru lives in Kuru town of Kamasadama. And there, he addressed the bhikkhus, which bhikkhus means monks, and he says, thus, bhikkhus. And he said, venerable sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So when we enter into this path, if you're anything like me, you started meditating probably because some of these things, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, dukkha, as we call it. And I value this kind of sales pitch, right? Where Jon Kabat-Zinn kind of sells it short, mindfulness-based stress reduction. The Buddha's like, that's cool and all, but this is for the disappearance of dukkha. This is for the disappearance of pain and grief. And that's what I'm looking for. And it's so beautiful that I find myself on this path because life fucking hurts, doesn't it? And this is for the disappearance of the suffering around that hurt. And it's so beautiful that even these words have just been passed down for thousands of years of people saying, this fucking hurts, doesn't it? This guy, the Buddha, found a way for us not to suffer so hard, for the disappearance of all of these things, sorrow, limitation, and dukkha, the disappearance of dukkha, and it's possible. And that's what got me on this path, not to manage my stress. You know, sometimes they talk about a kinder, gentler suffering. I'm not looking for kinder, gentler suffering. I've suffered enough. I'm for the disappearance of that shit. Let's go for it. And so whatever sorrow, lamentation, grief, despair, suffering you've been through, bring it in. Come on, let's go. Let that guide you on the path of discovering mindfulness, because this is it. Let's go see for ourselves. So, this is how we do this, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. This is how we do it. And so what are these four foundations? This is what we'll go over tonight. The first foundation is mindfulness of breath and body. And that's typically what we start with in meditation. We start with the breath. Anywhere you go meditate, you're probably going to hear, as you're breathing in, know you're breathing in, as you're breathing out, know you're breathing out. It's an amazing practice. I love it. I do it every day. And then from there, we have the second foundation of mindfulness of feelings. And I'll go into that in great detail. And then we also have mindfulness of the mind, that we can use the mind to view the mind, which is such a freeing practice. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of dhammas, mindfulness of the teachings of the Buddha. And so, let's dig in. I'm going to pass the mic to Callan as we enter into this first foundation.
All right. Thanks, Nikki. Yeah. So the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of breath and body. And, you know, it's not easy. We're often really lost in our thoughts, you know, living from the neck up. We can become absent from our own lives, you know, when we're living up here, time traveling, you know, reliving the past or thinking about the future, basically everywhere but the present moment. But our bodies have no choice but to be here. They're just here. They're our big glowing "you are here" sign. So our minds are wired to constantly be thinking, and that's not our fault. Just like the ears hear, the mind thinks. But we can practice bringing our awareness to the body. This can help build concentration and build a foundation for us to be more active participants in our lives. I found it to be a very grounding practice, and it's helped me to repair my relationship with my body. So in the sutta, the Buddha lays out some very clear instructions for how we should practice with all of these foundations. We're instructed to contemplate the different categories in some very specific ways: diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desire and discontent in regard to the world. So a level of diligence, or as Joseph Goldstein puts it, ardency, is necessary to cultivate a sense of urgency and commitment along the path. It's what keeps us coming back to the cushion. And so clear knowing, it's sort of like we want to know exactly what we're doing while we're doing it. I don't know if y'all ever get this, but I'll just find myself vacantly staring into the pantry, just like wanting something, waiting for something to appear, but I don't know why I'm there. So we want to know exactly what it is that we're doing while we're doing it. And so that brings us to mindfulness. And that's what we're here to cultivate, right? And it's more than, you know, just being present. Like, my, you know, animals are very present. They're not thinking about the past or the future. My cat's present, but he is definitely not mindful. So it's this sort of like meta awareness of being in the present moment, but also knowing what's happening, like having an awareness of our thoughts or feelings or actions. So when we are aware of what's going on in our bodies, you know, feelings arise in our bodies, we can take pause before we get reactive. And that's, you know, a really beautiful way that this practice can show up in our lives. So finally, the Buddha instructs us to practice free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. This refers to samadhi, or mental collectedness and concentration that we can attain when we're not wanting things to be different than how they actually are. So, you know, if I'm sitting and I'm just wishing that I had gotten more sleep or that my back didn't hurt so much, like, I'm not very concentrated. I'm not with my anchor. I'm clinging to, you know, it being a certain way. And when we are able to let go of some of those tendencies and develop concentration, there's real joy to be had in concentration. Like, when your mind and your body are exactly, like, in the same place at the same time, it's a good feeling. So, you know, and our minds will always wander, but every time that we go and come back, you know, remember to come back, remember the ground. Every time that happens, it's an opportunity for mindfulness. So now that we've talked about some of those mental states that we want to cultivate and keep in mind with each of the four foundations, let's talk about the specific practices that the Buddha outlines in the first foundation. So the sutta begins, "And how, monks, does he in regard to the body abide contemplating the body? Here, gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, he sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out." So the Buddha is telling us to find somewhere that is suitable for meditation. You know, we might not be able to go into the forest or, you know, sit at the root of a tree or have an empty hut, but we can have a little corner in our house, you know, with our meditation cushion or, you know, our chair, even our couch, just somewhere that's going to be, you know, less distracting to be in, where maybe you don't have like four TVs going at the same time around you. So he instructs us to find a posture that's suitable. And for seated meditation, you know, it can be being in a chair or sitting in a number of different seated styles on a cushion, like, you know, Burmese, or you can, you know, do full lotus. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I can't do that.
Well, I can't do full lotus. I've seen it done, though. People do it. Or kneeling posture, anything that you feel is supportive for your practice. It doesn't need to look a certain way. So next, the Buddha tells us to establish mindfulness in front of us. So we want to find where, and this is referring to the breath, mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. We want to find where we can feel the breath most easily. And, you know, y'all hear it in the guided meditations. It could be at the tip of your nose, or, you know, the rising and falling of your chest or of your abdomen. But just finding somewhere that it feels like you're going to be able to stay there with the breath and not, you know, switching it up too much. So breathing in, knowing that you're breathing in, having that sort of that awareness happening, that presence and awareness. And that can be our anchor for that practice. So the next section is mindfulness of body. So the Buddha says to experience the whole body and to calm the bodily formation with each breath. And so, you know, this can look like a lot of different things. A really great practice for this is a body scan, like what we did, you know, for our short sit earlier. I really enjoy doing body scans, and, you know, sometimes it's nice, like I've made a practice of just like trying to scan as slowly as I can, feeling as much as I can, and then I'll forget where I was, and then I'll start over at the top. It's a good way of being able to come into our bodies and, you know, not judging anything that we're feeling in our bodies, not feeling like the experience has to be a certain way. And, you know, this can also be listening to the sounds around you, just opening your senses up to the world around you. So the next section that the Buddha talks about is mindfulness of postures. So for formal practice, this can be seated meditation, walking meditation, and lying down meditation. I really love walking meditation. If y'all anybody who's been on retreats has probably practiced that before, but you do this like really slow walk where you feel, you know, your feet just like landing and shifting and then stepping. It's way slower than my body wants to go. Like I feel like my mind's always like, all right, come on, let's keep it going. But it's a really nice practice to, you know, be intentional and, you know, slow down a little bit when we might feel the urge to rush along. And it's also nice for if you're, you know, having a lot of pain in the body and seated meditation isn't very comfortable for you, or if you're feeling tired, it can be a really, really nice practice. So the next section is mindfulness of activities. So this can really truly be anything. You know, it could be an eating meditation. Like we, at retreats, at Heartwood, the Wild Heart retreats that happen there, I have never had better oatmeal in my life. That oatmeal is so good. And I think just, yeah, because you don't have so much going on. It's like you are only eating the oatmeal and like really experiencing the oatmeal. I think it also is just like good oatmeal, but it's, you know, how much do we rush through our meals? Or like, you know, if we're watching TV or something while we're eating, it's like, did I even taste that? Like there's so much nuance in life, like in anything that we do that we miss. Just because we're up here, we're somewhere else. You know, this could be dancing meditation. I love dancing. It can be a really joyful thing. It could be a hugging meditation when you're hugging your friend or your partner. Just really coming into your body and being in that moment with that person. So the next, and I'll just touch on these briefly. We will go into the next sections in more detail in the coming talks, but there are other practices outlined in this section of the sutta. The Buddha describes our bodies as basically being like a bag of rice, lots of different types of rice. And, you know, it's the 32 anatomical parts. It's an interesting image, but the, you know, purpose is to, you know, sort of not have this attachment to the body and, you know, be able to view it as its components and not as this like fixed self, like, oh, this is, you know, this is Callan, like being able to see all of those, you know, different systems that work together and how it's a process that's always changing. There's also an elements practice where you contemplate, you know, the classical fire, earth, air, water elements. And it sounds kind of esoteric, but I love this practice. It's awesome. Like just thinking about how all of these elements that, you know, make up the whole universe are also in my body. Like our bodies are made up of stars. And I don't know, it helps me to remember that, like, you know, not only am I in nature, but I'm also a part of nature. It's a nice practice to do when you're outdoors too. It can help foster that sense of connection. And so finally, there is a death contemplation. And specifically in the sutta, it's contemplation of corpses in various stages of decay. But, you know, for us, this it may sound morbid, but like death contemplation for me has been really motivating. Like once I, you know, sort of got over the initial, like, it's difficult to do, to be like, I'm going to die, you know, everyone will eventually. But it's like, it makes you consider, like, what's really important to you? Like, our time here is not permanent. We, you know, we're only here for a short amount of time.
I'm looking forward to that class when that comes time. So as we, you know, introduce the menu for the classes to come, you know, mindfulness of body, the first foundation, and all the ways it shows up, from death contemplation to the elements to mindfulness of breathing, all of these practices are wonderful and beautiful. As we step into the second foundation of mindfulness, we generally call that mindfulness of feelings. And the way we use that term feelings in English is such a broad way. You know, sometimes we talk about feelings like emotions. I feel sad, or like a physical feeling, like I feel hot, I feel cold, or preferential. I feel like eating pizza tonight, you know, something like that. And I heard somebody say there's like 14 different definitions for the word feeling. So in this context, we narrow it down to only three things. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And the term for this is vedana. Vedana. So in this foundation, as we bring our awareness into the body, is what felt known as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this isn't a preferential judgment of the moment. It's this impulsive, automatic function of having a body. So we have this body that all experience is known through. There's no other experience we are having besides what's known in this body. And we have six things. We have the eyes, we have the ears, we have the nose, we have the tongue, we have the body, and then even the mind is called a sense in Buddhism. And when the external and the internal collide, like a sound hits the ear, it's felt as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral automatically. In this practice of ending suffering, we're not trying to make every moment pleasant, because that's craving, that you'll suffer more. But what we want to do is develop clear seeing, tolerance, and compassion for unpleasant sensations as they arise. This has happened to me a million times. You're sitting in a group in meditation, and somebody's a mouth breather. What a wonderful practice! Mindfulness of unpleasant sound. And I can test myself to see how tolerant I can be and explore that sound mindfully and feel unpleasantness arise. Because that's where the freedom comes, when you're able to stay with the mouth breather instead of just getting up and punching the guy, right? You can actually be present. So this is the ending of suffering, is non-reactivity. As soon as we get stuck on that, my sense of well-being is reliant on this unpleasant sensation to be here and a pleasant sensation to be here, we're suffering. So there's so much freedom in just noting that is unpleasant. And that's okay. Oh, that's pleasant. That's nice. And then neutral. So here's the thing about this mindfulness practice. Let it come to you. Let it come to you. As much as you think the mind tells you, I am meditating, you're not. It's just meditation happening. You don't have to chase down, is that a pleasant feeling? Is that an unpleasant feeling? Well, if you don't know, it's neutral. The unpleasantness will come to you, trust me. And just note, it's unpleasant. And sometimes pleasure comes to you too. Yeah, that's nice. Have gratitude without clinging. Yeah, that's nice.
So letting sensation come to you through these six senses and note pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, we'll take some time with that one. But even though it's a very simple practice, it opens up to very profound things, especially in the sutta and in my own practice. So I just want to take time to introduce that as the second foundation of mindfulness, Vedana, feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. As we enter into the third foundation of mindfulness.
Mindfulness of mind. Yay. Third foundation. Minds do weird stuff. I'm glad that... Oh, I think it's dying. Can you guys still hear me? Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah, I'm glad that people can't read my mind. There's lots of weird shit happening, just like, I don't know, I'll be like reliving the 10th grade mentally, and then it's just like bossa nova on with just boop, doop, 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 doop. Like, can really run the gambit up here. And I don't think I'm alone. So the Buddha says, what one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So, you know, even though our minds do weird stuff, it's important to pay attention to what's going on up there. We can learn to recognize when our minds are lost in unwholesome mind states like craving, aversion, and delusion, and sort of change our course of action. And, you know, we can, in turn, like, be able to start recognizing when some of those unwholesome states aren't present and, you know, incline our minds towards, you know, things like loving kindness and compassion. So, yeah, we can kind of see how these, you know, these first three foundations of mindfulness can build into each other. So, you know, mindfulness of body, like you have a sense contact, you know, like how Mikey was saying earlier, like something, you know, comes in through your senses and then there's a feeling tone that arises, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And so the third foundation of mindfulness sort of explores the mind states that arise as a result of, you know, this contact with a sense object and then the feeling tone and then the ways in which our minds react to it. You know, so for instance, say, you know, I see a squirrel and the squirrel, you know, might remind me of my dad had a war with the squirrels when I was growing up in North Carolina. I'm from rural North Carolina, and like, he would kind of throw firecrackers at them. It was a little much, but, you know, so I'd see them, I'd be like, well, you're safe today. But, you know, my dad passed away,
not too long ago. And so that, like, sort of happy memory of him just, like, having this ridiculous conflict with animals, you know, just becomes, can morph into this sort of sadness and longing, you know, then I'm just like feeling this grief while I'm looking at a squirrel. And, you know, it, just like being able to recognize that change, and, you know, that's just an example, but being able to recognize when, you know, something, we have a contact with something like that, a sight or a sound or a taste or smell, and then we have those feelings that arise and then this, you know, mental states that can come out of it. And those mental states can really shift rapidly. They're not fixed or permanent. So the Buddha talks about, you know, several different categories of mind states for us to really watch out for, especially in our formal practice. But, you know, tonight for brevity's sake, three of the main ones to look out are the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. So we can notice when greed, you know, this sort of like wanting mind, you know, when we're craving for something to be better than it is, we can notice in our minds when present, you know, be like, oh, I have this like freedom and I'm wanting for things to be different than how they are right now. And we can also notice their absence. So hatred, you know, when we're feeling adverse to something, we want whatever's happening to stop. That's something that we can also, you know, notice in our minds. And same with, you know, delusion when we're often in la la lands. So these different mind states that arise become these sort of perception filters that through which we see the world. So it's, you know, like having different colors of sunglasses on, sort of. So these mental attitudes can change the way that we perceive people. These can change our interactions. Like, you know, when you're in an aversive mind state, you might like be more likely to flip somebody off in traffic, or, you know, think that the person that you were talking to is a real jerk, or, you know, it will change your perception of the way that, you know, things are around you. So they can sort of proliferate into our thoughts, emotions, and actions. Joseph Goldstein writes, while there is so much avoidable suffering in the world, or why is there so much avoidable suffering in the world? Violence, war, hunger, injustice, or the difficulty in our personal relationships. That suffering is just these unwholesome states being acted out. So, you know, we can take note of these mental states and just know them to be what they are. You know, it's not who we are. It's just a mental state. It's just a thought. It's nothing to take personally. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, mind precedes all mental states. Mind is the chief. They're all mind brought. If with an impure mind a person speaks or acts, suffering follows him like the wheel that follows the foot of the ox. So whatever one thinks or ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So, you know, whatever we practice, we get better at. So if we're practicing angry mind all the time, you know, we're going to keep having angry mind because that's what we've just been doing. You know, it could just be our coping mechanism. But we might, you know, sort of get a story in our heads like, God, why am I such an angry person? Why am I such a sad person? You know, thinking that there's some sort of, like, character flaw, something that's wrong with us, when it's just a mental state that's been left unchecked. So, you know, by noticing this in our seated meditation practice, like, we can let go of these states and stop identifying with them. And this will ultimately inform our actions and how we treat others around us. And, you know, it makes the world just a little bit better, even if it's only by one person.
Hmm. Yeah. And as we make way to the fourth foundation of mindfulness of dhammas, or dharmas, you may hear, and that's the Pali is dhammas, dharmas is Sanskrit, faced with that translation dilemma again. And what we're using this word dhammas is in context of the Buddhist teachings, mindfulness of the Buddhist teachings. So what we're teaching here tonight and every time we're in this room is practice. This is something we do, not necessarily just intellectualize about. We put it to practice. And so this fourth foundation are the lists that we go through. So there's the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, the seven factors of awakening, the four noble truths. And this is kind of like the grab bag of the Buddhist teachings in the fourth foundation. And so this word sati, like I said, is to remember. So it's remember the Buddhist teachings. And when you come here enough, you hear something, and then you go out into the world, and you go, oh yeah, I remember they were talking about that. So when we talk about mindfulness of the four noble truths, the first noble truth is dukkha, that life will have unsatisfying qualities to it. And it's such a freeing thing. So when something pisses me off or something doesn't seem right in the world, I go, oh, that's dukkha.
remember, that's dukkha. And if we're free in that moment. So we want to remember any of the practices we learned today. Remember the breath is available. Remember pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Remember that's just a thought. Remember anything that comes from this practice, because that's how they had to pass this practice down, by remembering these teachings. And let these teachings ingrain in you. My teacher's teacher, it says there's coarse cultivation and true cultivation. Okay, coarse cultivation is when you have to memorize these things. So you may not know the Four Noble Truths off the top of your head. So get the books, read them, so you get that coarse cultivation, so you start to memorize it. And then the true cultivation is when you start living the Four Noble Truths mindfully out in the world, because now you have it memorized by heart, right? And so this is the fourth foundation when we take these practices to heart. This isn't an intellectual thing. Remember, these teachings are to aid you in the ending of suffering, not just an intelligent thing we're describing here. So, making any adjustments while we shift into doing a four foundations of mindfulness overview practice. So, find yourself in a supportive posture.